Blog Talk Radio.
This is our common ground, alternative activist empowerment talk radio, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? What language did you speak then?
I am a revolutionary.
It's about what we didn't do.
Amen.
Then it speaks to us and the possibility for us as a future person. Because ultimately, our people's future resides on what we do outside of the White House.
African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God...
Our Common Ground with Janice Graham.
Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. Our Common Ground, a higher ground for discourse, discussion, solutions, and ideas.
I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you.
Talk that matters. Transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
And now to Our Common Ground with Janice Graham.
And good evening to all of you here on Our Common Ground. Thank you for joining us tonight. We hope that you are well, and we hope you're getting in your seats. We're going to have a full house tonight, and we've got a full program for you, one which we think will carry you for many, many months to come. As many of you know, we're coming into this broadcast this week with two more black men who have unnecessarily met their deaths, with the Supreme Court dropping the second shoe against liberty and democracy in our country, with a $28 million rehabilitation of the Memphis-based African American History Museum, which opened on today, and with smoke signals from the right-wing evangelical nut jobs with a new enemy, and his name is Neil deGrasse Tyson. We want to remind you, as we always do with one of our drops of Be Carefuls, that while we are raising our black fists in righteous indignation of the war against poor people in this country, that we should pause and be clear about who poor people really are. I know that many of you who struggle to pay the bills every day, who struggle to pay the rent, to make the mortgage payment, and to do many things for your children that you need to do, that you want to do because you want them to love you, believe as you come and go from your jobs that you are poor. Perhaps in your personal economy you are. But we remind you here at Our Common Ground to give pause, to think about who truly the poor people in this country are. They are not people who have cell phones to call us at Our Common Ground. They're not people who have internet connection to listen to this broadcast or to spend time on Facebook or Twitter. They are people who are holding fast with the edges of their nails. That gives us pause, but it also gives us purpose. Thank you once again. If you'd like to join us in our chat room, you can do so by coming to www.blogtalkradio.com/, that's to the right, OCG, www.blogtalkradio.com/OCG. And those of you who are having whatever internet connections that you might have and you'd like to call us on your smart device, our number is 347-838-9852, and we'll make room for you to listen on your smart device. And we're going to get going with our program. Thank you once again for being with us tonight. We are here each Saturday, 10 p.m. Tonight at Our Common Ground, we are going to honor and learn from the life of a witness from the bridge. She is Dr. Joyce A. Ladner. She came to change a nation in her youth and to lift up her people. And there is much that we can learn from her life achievement, and her life purpose. And she'll be joining us. But first, before we begin, our witness from the bridge episode, which is the third one. We have had two other witnesses from the bridge, our sister and elder, Florence Tate, and our scholar, leader, Dr. Ruby Sales. And we also want to do a shout-out to Reverend Dr. Susan K. Smith and Reverend Dr. Ruby Sales, who are our Common Ground voices, for their induction into the Martin Luther King Preachers Hall of Fame in Atlanta, Georgia, this week. But this week also marked the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And while we stand firmly on our common ground, we could not go by without pausing to remember that leader.
Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow men. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah.
A long life, longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you.
Less than 24 hours after he spoke those words, Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. And as I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black. I'm proud of it. I'm black and beautiful.
Common ground. Tonight, our Witness from the Bridge series. We are honoring and celebrating the life of Dr. Joyce A. Ladner. She is an icon of the civil rights movement era, a symbol of women exercising scholastic inquiry into our lives as a people, a stalwart leader in public policy research, education, and social service programming affairs. She is our witness from the bridge tonight, sharing her life's learning and her vision and aspiration for our people, and we are pleased to present her as an Our Common Ground Witness from the Bridge.
The four SNCC helped to end segregation. Our legal system undermined the very rights and privileges that it should have been protecting.
It's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine.
I tell all the young people I meet that the students of SNCC, did you wake up one day and say we're going to march? Didn't wake up one day and said we're going to sit in. We studied. We prepared. We studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We listened to Jim Lawson. We learned from Jim Foreman. We learn from Bob Moses. We learn from Fannie Hamer. We were inspired by a militant and fiery radical like Ella Baker. But Ella was fiery. She was militant. She was radical.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine.
Great progress. And while we must, I think, make peace with the past, we must never forget it, and we must never dismiss it.
I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Why can't they hear us more clearly? What are we so busy doing that we can afford to abandon them and then have the arrogance and the nerve to accuse them for being lost?
I am here still running, I believe. We came from a family that were not civil rights activists, but had for generations, you know, passed on this the idea that you're as good as anybody. And it really goes back five generations to the grandfather, four generations removed, who taught his children, who were mixed race, and he was white and their mother was Creek Indian, that no one is better than you. And he also said that he would not have his blood spilled across the country, and that he would not enslave his own children, they would not be sold and bought and so on. That was the concept of you're as good as anybody, and always look white people straight in the eye and don't blink when you're talking to them. Demand respect that way from them. Do not allow them to walk over you. Was what was taught to us over and over again. And it was, I didn't think anything about it at the time, but in trying to figure out what were those influences that led us to activism, I think it had to do with us growing up feeling that we had a right to demand equal treatment at the time and the place and to the parents that young movement people were born to. It was through an accident of history that we were that post-war generation in the South at the time who had the parents who taught us stand up for yourself, that all of that thing, I mean, you're talking about synchronicity and serendipity, all those things fell into place for a small group of young people, and that was our generation. A king standing up in Montgomery and people saying, well, you're right. It was, for us, it was almost like you had to do it. It was a matter of time. The time had come. And they expected so much of us. They have felt they couldn't do anything about it. There was this spirit of rising expectations that we would do it.
We were like you young people are today. No different. The only difference is that we found a calling. As the Algerian psychiatrist Frantz Fanon said, each generation must find its mission, fulfill it or betray it. We were ordinary young people doing extraordinary things. We didn't know we would change the course of history, but we sure knew that we would do everything possible to try. We didn't think in broad terms about one day the society is going to be so different and so on. We were fighting one battle at a time. Community service is the rent you pay for being on earth. That you had to have a strong belief in something. We learned in our homes and schools and churches that beliefs aren't worth very much if you're not willing to stand up for them. So having the courage of our convictions was the most important thing that defined us. We may have gotten away from it today, but we must find ways to get back to it.
In the summer of 1963, the busiest year of the civil rights movement, Americans from North and South made plans to hold the greatest demonstration for freedom in American history. A. Philip Randolph, whose plan for a march in 1941 forced President Roosevelt to desegregate wartime industries, was the march's visionary. He and Bayard Rustin rallied civil rights organizations, unions, and all faiths to mass on the National Mall for civil rights and economic opportunity. And then they arrived by bus, traveling from as far away as San Francisco, and they arrived by train. They sang and talked and planned along the way. At the end of a long day, Martin Luther King changed history.
It was so different. It was so simple back then. Not like today with all the social media and a thousand television networks. The people's access to news was much more limited. And so word of mouth and one-on-one, real live people going out meant a great deal. In the office, we all functioned as one staff under Bayard. There was a daily staff meeting at the end of the day, and sometimes the end of the day could come at midnight when we put in long hours. The closer it got to the date of the march, things got more and more hectic. Sometimes people would come in off the street in Harlem, come into the office and say, I understand this is where you people are organizing to take people down to the march. I'd like to go. And, you know, it was very touching in many ways.
It was these values of kinship and family, responsibility, and religion that served as the foundation of the movement. And for those leaders like Martin Luther King, Fannie Lou Hamer, Rosa Parks, Ella Baker, Dorothy Cotton, Andy Young, and many others. In all his eloquence, Dr. King voiced his strong sentiments in a speech he gave at Abbott House in 1965 when he said, I quote, for no other group in American life is the matter of family more important than to the Negro. Our very survival is bound up in it. No one in all history had to fight against so many physical and psychological horrors to have a family life, as did we. Our families held on to each other at all costs, and our communities fought to remain intact when all else was against them. It is that same struggle for family that we see in the movie 12 Years a Slave, when Simon Northrop longs to be reunited with his wife and children after he's been sold into slavery as a free man. And it is the same struggle that we see each day in our neighbors and friends who are trying to hold it all together and make a way out of no way despite the difficulties they face.
Pioneer of the civil rights movement. Beginning in her youth, she came to change a nation and to lift up her people. Sociologist, academician, scholar, and activist. A witness from the bridge. Tonight at Our Common Ground. A witness from the bridge. Dr. Joyce A. Ladner.
You're listening to Our Common Ground with Janice Graham. Transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you for being with us tonight. Stay tuned.
She was born in Battles, Mississippi on March 12, 1943. But grew up in Hattiesburg. In high school, she became involved in the civil rights movement. She and her sister, Dory, were expelled from Jackson State College in Jackson, Mississippi, for participating in the civil rights protests. She and her sister, Dory, transferred to Tougaloosa College in Tougaloosa, Mississippi, where she earned her BA degree in sociology in 1964. And went on to Washington University and St. Louis, Missouri, to earn a PhD in 1968. She was mentored by three civil rights martyrs, Vernon Darman, Clyde Kennard, and Medgar Evers. She became active in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1961 and worked in Mississippi, Southwest Georgia, and she was SNCC's representative on the national staff of the March on Washington in 1963. She was arrested for attempting to worship at the all-white Galloway Methodist Church in Jackson, Mississippi. After earning her PhD, Ladner went on to teach at the university level. She did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Dar es Salaam in 1971. She published her first book in 1971, Tomorrow's Tomorrow, The Black Woman, A Study of Poor Black Adolescent Girls from St. Louis. That same year, Joyce Ladner began teaching at Howard University. In 1973, she joined the faculty of Hunter College at the City University of New York. She lived in Dakar, Senegal in 1980 to 81, where her husband, Walter Carrington, was United States Ambassador. Joyce Ladner returned to teach at Howard University in 1981, and she served as president for academic affairs from 1990 to 1994 and as interim president of the Howard University from 1994 to 1995, the first woman in America to do so. In 1995, President Bill Clinton appointed her to the District of Columbia Financial Control Board, where she oversaw the finances and budgetary restructuring of the public school system. She was also a senior fellow in the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution of Washington, D.C. think tank and research organization from 1998 to 2003. She has authored and edited 7 books. She has appeared on nationally syndicated radio and television programs and is writing her memoirs titled Stand Up Straight on Coming of Age During the Civil Rights Movement. And we are so pleased to introduce to you and to enter into a discussion of the life and achievements and lessons of Joyce Ladner. Dr. Joyce Ladner, thank you so very much for joining us. We are so pleased and privileged to have you.
I'm pleased to be here.
Well, thank you so very much for joining us, and you are indeed a witness from the bridge.
I didn't know you were talking about me.
Oh, indeed. You know, you have been an icon, an image in my life for a very, very long time.
Nice to hear.
Very early years. I remember on the bus traveling back to Florida from the March on Washington in 1963, and the adults talking about the young women. And you and your older sister Dory were one of those people that they were talking about. And I was sitting and reflecting on, that's what I want to do. And I was only 13 years old at the time.
Wow.
So thank you so very much for your passion, your contribution, the way in which you have modeled for what it means to be a movement woman, a movement leader. And I so very much am enamored and impressed and thankful for you and for a grateful black people and nation for what you have, how you have used your life.
Yeah, well, I was always interested in, go on, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You were interested in?
Well, as you know, from my early years, I was always interested in two things, understanding what's going on and also trying to change conditions that I felt were not fair. So it was, I combined, you know, I am what I called a scholar activist, you know, or I was a student activist. I was always sort of in school getting my education because as a first-generation college in my immediate family, you know, I just felt that I had to get a college degree. But at the same time, it was a matter of, what shall I say, of having to change the conditions around us. They just couldn't remain as they were. And we were also challenged by our elders to bring about changes as well, because I remember my great uncle who'd been in World War One in France challenged us kids by telling us that, well, actually what happened, we used to sit with him on the back porch of his house and listen with him to Jackie Robinson playing baseball. And every time Jackie Robinson came to bat, Uncle Archie had this kind of infectious laughter, and he was so excited. But he always ended by saying, "Now you girls have to be the Jackie Robinsons of your generation." Mm-hmm. And I didn't always know what he meant, you know, by it for sure, but I knew it involved something important.
I think it's very important for us to be able to point to the lights in our lives, the people who turn on the light.
Right. It was very, very important because he had made so many sacrifices himself. He used to tell us stories about how the French people would ask him, you know, to see his monkey tail, and how painful that was to him. He was abroad fighting for freedom, you know, but he was not. And then he returned home like all those veterans of World War II who had fought for democracy abroad and who came back home with conditions being the same as they were when they left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so his challenge to us was very, very important, you know.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, Dr. Ladner, about your early education. Who were your teachers? What was the segregated school system like in Mississippi prior to your going off to getting expelled from Jackson State? I love that story.
Well, I was glad that they put me out of there because I hated that school.
And they definitely put you out.
Yeah, they did. In fact,
Your early education? Who were the teachers? Who were the principals?
You know, I always think when I was 3.5 years old, my mother, my older sister Dory, who's just a year older than I, had gone on to school, and mother took me by the hand one day, and we went down to the home of the principal. He lived in our neighborhood, and she told him that. She asked him if she could bring me to school, if I could come to school with Dory, with my sister, to play because I was lonely at home by myself. And I remember I was tiny, I was very little. And he said, "If you give this little girl a cigar and have her bring it to me tomorrow at my office, I'll see what I can do." And I remember that. It was one of my earliest recollections. So mother took me to his office and with that cigar, and I actually started real school, as we called it. Playing. And my first teacher was a wonderful woman whose name was Zola Jackson. She taught me to read. I still have just an enormous gratitude for Miss Jackson for what she taught me. She I remember one time I kept walking to her desk, and she said, "Little girl, if you don't stop walking back and forth to my desk asking me, 'Miss Jackson, Miss Jackson, is this right?' you're going to get holes in the sole of your shoes." And I didn't know what that meant. I mean, I was trying to figure out the holes in the soles. I didn't even have the vocabulary for it. But Miss Jackson was one of those people who, like all of our teachers, took tremendous pride in our ability to learn, and so she actually she was the grandmother of what's his name, I forgot his name now, but of one of our professional basketball players, but she felt that every child could learn. All of our teachers felt that every child could learn, and there was no such thing as uneducable or fancy vocabulary that's used today. They took pride in using their very, very minimal resources to reach every child. And so that's what it was like. All of us, we didn't really know we were poor until we were told later on that we were, after a fashion, because we achieved tremendously. And they, our teachers had very little. I remember they used to go to summer school at places like Indiana University to get their master's degrees, or and they went every summer, you know, to continue their education. They were just extraordinary people, very industrious people too. They were part of our communities. They lived in in the neighborhood, and so their interest in us was because they because we could have been their children. They came to our house if something was wrong. You know, they kept in touch. I used to always go back to visit my teachers when I was after I got out of high school and later out of college and so on.
The reason I ask you this particular question is because I think that there are many black people who do not understand the culture of the black South.
Right.
That during segregation, we had, there was a flexibility even in the schools to bend the arc of the universe toward justice for black people in our own way.
Absolutely. And we had everything we needed, as it were, in a way. We had our churches, our lives revolved around our own churches, our own schools. They may not have had all the equipment that we needed, but we were complete in a way. We were not culturally deprived.
It was an enriching environment.
A very enriching environment.
Yes, both in terms of what you saw. I mean, I attended segregated schools until I was in the ninth grade. And I know that you attended segregated public schools all of your
12th grade until I graduated.
Yes. So people need to really have a great understanding of the richness and the empowerment that system offered. Because a lot of people, Joyce, ask me about the question of what is the difference between our generation and the generation after our generation. And I believe that there is a great attribution to what happened to black children in segregated schools in the South, which is why you can point to huge accomplishments from black kids who came out of the segregated system.
Exactly. We had people who cared about us and made the ultimate investment and sacrifice on our behalf. And I think it had a lot to do with accountability. They made themselves accountable. No one had to tell them that they had to be accountable for the students' learning, or the students learning to read and to write and do very basic things. They automatically assumed it was their responsibility, and they took great pride in doing so.
They had a definition of excellence.
Of excellence that we don't have today. Absolutely.
Exactly. Now, when you left home, you were in Hattiesburg when you graduated from high school.
Yes.
And I have not seen, in looking at your bios and your background, whether or not how you fared in high school, but I assume you were, if not the valedictorian, the salutatorian of your class.
I was valedictorian, and my sister, Dora, was the salutatorian.
I just guessed that. Looking at how your life, that you were scholastically superior, even in high school. So you went on, both of you went on to Jackson State College, and that didn't work out too well because you had a sense of community.
had a sense of community, and I got expelled because for helping to organize the first civil rights demonstration on that campus. What happened is that we had, in high school, we had gotten to know Medgar Evers because he was, let me back up just a little. When we were quite young, our mother's best friend took us with her to, and her brother, Vernon Damer, who was one of the civil rights martyrs who was murdered. They used to take us with them to Jackson to the statewide NAACP meetings. And that's when I first met Medgar Evers. I was maybe 13 years old, I guess. So what happened is once I got to college, my sister Dora and I would go to Medgar's office. It was illegal against the rules to go there, the college rules to go there, because he was, in quotes, an agitator, agitator for change. And one time we went by his office, he told us that there was going to be a civil rights, a sit-in at the public library. And of course, we kept it quiet. I mean, it was, but we asked him if we could be a part of it. And he said, at first he said, yes, that would be good. And then later he said, you know, I wouldn't know what to tell your mother if you got arrested, and you will be arrested. So what you should do instead is to organize a sympathy protest on campus after the students at Tougaloo College nearby, you know, about 8 miles away, are arrested. And so I remember staying in my dorm all that that day, on the day that the demonstration was to take place. And then finally when I heard it on the radio, I was so happy. And a group of us got together and said we were going to have this sympathy prayer meeting that evening on the way to the library. And all the students would see the group of folks out there, and they'd stop. And you had to do everything surreptitiously. You couldn't say, well, we're going to organize this because, you know, and the cops would have been called and everything else. We would have been put in prison and parchment penitentiary for doing this. So that evening, we were in one of the students was in the middle of praying when we heard this voice screaming, you better stop it, you better stop it. And it turned around, and it was the president of the college, Jacob Reddix. And he was livid. He was so upset. He'd never had, you know, lost control. These guys were, presidents of these colleges were hired to maintain control. That was all, that was their job. And so it was like a glorified plantation in a way, and he was the boss, the overseer. And so right after he came, he was just running from one group of students to the other, said, stop this, stop this. He was absolutely out of control. It was crazy. So at one point he stopped near my room, two roommates and myself, and he pushed my roommate, whose name was Eunice, and knocked her down to the ground. Oh, what did he do that for? We forgot that we were demonstrating against, you know, for the Tougaloo students. We turned on him, of course. And then they brought the police dogs on the campus, and the next day we boycotted classes and so on. And by noon, you know, we decided we were going to march to the courthouse where the Tougaloo College, who had sat in at the public library, were being arraigned. We'd gotten a few blocks from campus, and when the police dogs were brought out, and I remember hearing this pop-pop sound. I thought it was, I screamed, I remember screaming, oh, they're trying to kill us, you know, but it was actually tear gas, and that's how tear gas sounds. It sounds like a gun going off. So we were chased by the police dogs, and there's nothing worse than being chased by a dog. I mean, it was like some subliminal, fearful thing out of slavery where the hounds are chasing you. So we were, you know, pushed back to, I hid in the home of a black woman, and other students were hiding, and people opened up their houses to keep us safe. And I remember getting back to campus late, a
couple of hours later, and then the next day, the police, the president of the college closed the campus early for spring break. When we got back, the dean of students told us, oh, by the way, with my roommate Eunice, the dean of students came over to our dorm that night and told her that the president had expelled her, and we were asking him, expelled for what? She didn't do anything. He knocked her down. But yet she had to leave, and when her parents, she had to be off campus, believe it or not, before daybreak. So what do you tell a 17-year-old girl, you know, who has done nothing wrong and who is being expelled because she was knocked to the ground by the president of the college? Students were saying you shouldn't go, and the next day, that night, say about 3 o'clock in the morning, her parents had arrived from down on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi to pick her up, and they tried to see the president of the college the next day. Being the person he was, he refused to see them, and I lost contact with Eunice, and I've often wondered whatever happened to her. One of these days I'm going to try to find her. But it was awful, and we were kids. I mean, I turned 17 by then, you know, and we were all young. I mean, it was mm-hmm. horrible, but we prevailed. But when we got back, you know, from spring break, that was when the dean of students called my sister and me in and told us that we were being expelled, and we were. Not to be outdone, we told him, fine, we hate this school anyway. We're going to transfer to Tougaloo College, which was cost twice as much as Jackson State. We hadn't talked to our parents or anybody about transferring, but it all worked out. And by the time I got to Tougaloo, which has, you know, this tremendous reputation for being the civil rights college, you know, it was wonderful. I felt like I had finally exhaled for the first time in my life. You know,
all these experiences really prepared you for what was to come as you became part of the leadership, student leadership of SNCC.
I guess so, you know, but at the time you're young and you're just so busy living life that you don't know,
uh-huh.
you don't think about any of this. We were just doing what we felt we were supposed to be doing, you know. It was nothing conscious about it. At the same time, we were doing, having demonstrations, organizing demonstrations, doing voter registration work. We were also, you know, studying. We were also having our parties and doing other things like young people do.
But
we had this passion for changing things. And I think some of my friends, you know, fathers had been. In the NAACP before. See, a lot of the early leadership of the movement came from people like Amzie Moore in the Delta of Mississippi, who had been in the military, and they came back, and they were determined, you know, to change things. And they were our role models, and not enough credit is given to these people. But had it not been for people like Amzie Moore, for Medgar Evers and others, you know, things would not have changed, but they told us that it was going to change and we were going to be part of that change,
mm-hmm.
and I'm grateful for it. But it was an accident of history in a way that accident in the sense that we were born when we were born to at a time of great challenge of this post-war children, first-generation college, and if there's one the symbolic personification of all of this, it was the lynching of Emmett Till, who was our age. And
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, everybody in SNCC that I know saw the cover of Emmett Till's body on the cover of Jet Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And mm-hmm. we all vowed, you know, that we're going to change this. This is just not going to be allowed to exist. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It was a pivotal moment in my life in a very grave way until I saw and read that story in Jet Magazine, which we always received every Wednesday, Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that children died.
Well, none of us did, because even in the worst cases, you know, men were lynched. Children were spared. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't think we were invulnerable by any means. But I sure didn't know that white people were, there were white people who were mean and evil enough to kill children.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I remember asking Emmett Till's mother when I met her back in the 80s, why did she insist on having his body unembalmed, shown, she didn't allow them to do any cosmetic surgery to make him look presentable or anything. She said, I wanted the world to see what they did to my baby.
What they
and
did to my son. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that did took a lot of courage. Here's someone, a mother who's, you know, just distraught over what had happened to her child, and yet she had the presence of mind to say that people ought to see this. They ought to know what happened to him. They should know what went wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
I admired her tremendously, because I don't think I could have done that. I mean,
let me ask you about your work with SNCC and in the many years of recruiting and organizing. Were you aware that the whole world was watching what you were doing?
No, not at all. Some people. And not until, say, about 1964, when things really got, when the movement began to get nationalized in a way in the 1963 or so, around the time of the March on Washington. Prior to then,
mm-hmm.
it really was a Southern movement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that we had friends of SNCC, that we had people who sent us contributions. In fact, I used to answer Bob Moses' mail. He was too busy doing other things. He asked me if I would write thank you letters to the people who were sending, you know, checks. I remember one couple from Westchester County in New York sent $500, and that was a lot of money back then. A lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wrote them and thanked them. And we had, you know, campus chapters, friends of SNCC on campuses around the country. But
uh-huh.
I didn't really know that the entire world was watching until later. Because we were so busy trying to...
Mm-hmm.
We were busy trying to get people to take note of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was hard to get publicity. For example, if there was a demonstration, I'll never forget being in Greenwood, Mississippi, in spring break 1963, and you know, it was very violent. I remember, and we were trying to get publicity. The people who covered us were Dan Rather, CBS.
Mm-hmm.
We were covered by Claude Sitton of Newsweek. But you could count them on one hand. Everybody was not out there trying to cover the civil rights movement. And our job was to try to get people to publicize what was going on, because a lot of it wasn't publicized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was
I remember that I worked with my father and my mother, who were recruiting people to go to the March on Washington. So it was a matter of, there was no email, there was no none of that. It was a matter of, you get in the car and you go into neighborhoods and you knock on doors.
Right. Right.
And
we went
into one home, and the man that was there was just a man in the neighborhood. And he said to my father, it's not going to be Kennedy, it's not going to be Eisenhower, it's going to be the people of Mississippi, the Negroes, of the colored people of Mississippi and Georgia, that's going to stop this nonsense. I will never forget that.
Wow, you have tremendous memory, too, you know.
Yeah, I think when they started the recruitment, I wasn't even 13 yet.
Wow.
These stories really stay with you, because they are so pivotal in your life, and you're trying to, as a young person, to transpose them into what it means for you on that day.
Right,
but
exactly.
My mother kept saying to me, tomorrow is a word that you misspell all the time. Today, you need to remember how to spell it correctly because this is what it's about.
That's amazing.
It really is amazing. I want to talk to you about the work that you did as the representative of SNCC on the organizing committee of the March of 63. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to get into that phase of your life and then to talk about your work as a sociologist, as a scholar, as an educator, so that our audience gets an idea of how your life lessons have been fed into the future. You're listening
okay.
to Our Common Ground, and we are talking with our witness from the bridge, Dr. Joyce A. Ladner. You stay tuned. We'll be right back.
To clutch for power, not needing the light just to shine on me. I need to be one.
When we put in long hours. The closer it got to the date of the march, things got more and more hectic. Sometimes people would come in off the street in Harlem, come into the office and say, I understand this is where you people are organizing to take people down to the march. I'd like to go. And
struggling myself, don't mean a whole lot. I've come to realize.
You're listening to Our Common Ground with Janice Graham, transforming truth to power, one broadcast at a time.
There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending. When you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
What we see before our eyes, the sky is green and the grass is blue. But one thing you can't deny, these people are sabotaging this economy and these people are sabotaging this country.
And also on TruthWorks Network, the best of political pushback.
Go for it, Alpha.
This is how we do it. It's Friday night.
The Alpha Show.
Oh, I'm buzzing the club.
Because our society is only as strong as all its individuals, the United Negro College Fund has helped educate thousands of doctors and researchers, but we need more. Thousands of architects and engineers, but we need more. Thousands of teachers and biologists, but we need more. And when disease, injustice, pollution, poverty, and countless other problems threaten to pull us apart, we had better educate every single person who has the potential to solve our problems. And to educate more people, we need more of your help. Give to the United Negro College Fund. With so much at stake, a mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Truth Works Network. Truth Works. Truth Works Network.
Live from the Truth Works Network studio at Blog Talk Radio and Our Common Ground Media Production. The Black Voice Collaborative.
The Alpha Show Alpha, serving his politics with hot grips. Soul Emergence. With Peter E. Matthews, Reconciling for Revolution.
Special broadcast series, Working While Black, Black Women in the Prison, and Power Views. The truth must be spoken more than once. Only on TruthWorks Network. You can find TruthWorks Network on Facebook. Like us and learn more about us.
People like Jay-Z would say that his presence alone is a contribution when in his back and forth with Harry Belafonte. You know, it bothers me terribly that a Lil Wayne would use Emmett Till's death in a song in the most derogatory way possible. It bothers me that young people don't get it. I don't blame them entirely, but I don't let them off the hook either. Because you have each generation, as Frantz Fanon once said, to paraphrase him, each generation must define its mission and fulfill it or betray it. I think there are a lot of young people out here who are doing wonderful things, great things. And you don't have to, they don't have the conditions we've lived under of life and death. So I don't expect the same thing from them. In fact, I think they have to decide how they're going to fight the struggle. But we decided, I call ours the Emmett Till generation, because, you know, to a person, everybody I know in SNCC saw the picture of Emmett Till's grotesque body after he'd been bloated on the cover of Jet magazine, and we vowed then that we one day.
I won't give anything away until we have it all.
Thank you for being with us here tonight on Our Common Ground as we honor a witness from the bridge and discuss her life accomplishments, her life purpose, and her life's aspiration and passion for her people. Dr. Joyce A. Ladner, thank you so very much again for joining us. If you'd like to join us in this conversation and you have a question for Dr. Ladner, our number is 347-838-9852. Dr. Ladner, before we went to break, we were coming up to your leadership in the organizing of the March on Washington. Let me ask you, did you ever expect the hundreds of thousands of people who would arrive?
No, we didn't. We thought we hoped that the people would come, but we had no idea as to how many would show. This was during the days of using the old mimeograph machine where you of telephones. There were no faxes. There was no email and so on. So we did everything by mail. One of the staff members wrote a brochure on how to organize. And a lot of the work was done at the ground level. I mean, we did more coordinating than organizing in one sense, and organizing, of course, a lot in another. The march would not have come off like it did had there not been the people like your parents who were out there trying to get people to go to Washington. But I remember early on the morning of the march, Rustin had gotten out to the mall at about, I guess, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. He and Cortland Cox were out there, and Byard was wondering, well, I wonder if they're going to come. And I got there about 7:30 or so because a group of us in SNCC went to pick at the Justice Department to if we had three of our SNCC members, organizers who were in jail in Southwest Georgia for sedition, for overthrowing the state because they were organizing people to go register to vote. And we hadn't been able to get any publicity around that, so we felt that since we were in D.C., we could picket. After the picketing, my sister and I walked over to the mall, and people still hadn't come. And slowly began to see, you know, people coming in ones and twos. A lot of them were local people from D.C. And then groups, and then they started coming and coming and coming. It was incredible to see all those people. And the most extraordinary, if there's, I mean, I have a number of memories from that day, but one memory was of standing on the podium on the Lincoln Memorial, because I had a stage pass so I could go up on the podium, and look, had the experience of looking out at all those people. No one on that stage had ever seen that many people before. There was no one in America who'd probably seen that many people before. We didn't have huge gatherings like that back then. And so that was just truly, truly remarkable. And but when the people did turn out, it was just so gratifying to know that they came and to see people marching under banners from, whether it was Westchester County or Wilkes-Barre or your town in Florida, or you know the NAACP from New Haven, or from Jackson, Mississippi, or from Alabama, or the Albany, Georgia contingent, you know, the Corps from New Orleans, all those different groups converging there. And that's when I had this just most wonderful, warm and fuzzy feeling, an indescribable feeling that these people, these are all people who believe in what we believe in. They support us. That was the first time I really saw the broad base of the support. Because it was very isolating down in the South,
mm-hmm.
very, very isolating and isolated. It was dangerous. It was there weren't very many people. You hear a lot of people say, "I marched with Dr. King." They may have, you know, but the core, hardcore group of people who were in it, you know, no matter what, was small. There weren't hundreds of there weren't thousands of people really. You saw thousands at a big march, but the day-to-day hard grinding work involved handfuls of people. And so it was so great to get out of the Deep South and to come north and to see how broad the support base
mm-hmm.
was or could potentially become.
Mm-hmm. I know that our bus left West Palm Beach from a bus that started in Miami.
Oh,
and it
stopped
right up the East Coast, picking people up. All there were like four or five, Jacksonville, the people from Orlando and Tampa were someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I was so little. I wasn't paying very much attention. But one of the big discussions as the bus got to West Palm Beach was my father and my uncle were very adamant that the banner on the side of the bus that was attached to the bus had to be taken down once we went into Central Florida.
Oh,
I remember I remember my Uncle Dyson saying, unless you don't want this bus to be a target and people
mm-hmm.
get hurt, this banner got to come down.
You'd probably take it down today in Central Florida, too, wouldn't you?
Yes, absolutely. So it was interesting, but let me ask you to reflect on as you stood on the Lincoln Memorial and you looked down on that particular crowd and what was happening there and understanding the import of what was happening. Did you reflect as you sat at the first inauguration of Barack Obama on that moment?
Yes, because what I thought about was that when I had the other large demonstration I'd been at on the mall, and I'd gone to anti-war, poor people's campaign, you know, all of the big marches of the 60s, I was there. But I thought about how far we'd come. I thought about Atlantic City and when the Freedom Democratic Party of Mississippi had gone to Atlantic City in, 1 year later, 1964, and had been essentially denied any democracy there because we were there to challenge the all-white segregated Mississippi delegation at the Democratic National Convention. I thought about how we had been sort of kicked out of Atlantic City in a way, in a nice way, and yet here was a man, you know, more than 40 years later, who now was the President of the United States. And I think he has acknowledged many times that had it not been for that early struggle in the South, he would not have been president, nor would we have all these elected officials, nor would a lot of other changes have occurred. I'm not one who believes all the change is a result of what my small band of people did, but I think it was a coalescing of people, time, energy over time, you know, that brought about these changes. I'll tell you one thing, Janice, if I may say. So during the March, 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, I did a lot of speaking and so on about the earlier march, and I had so many people say, thank you for what you did, but it sounded strange to me, like, why are they thanking me? And it's because I didn't think I was to be thanked. I did what I was doing for myself and for my family and for my community and for everybody, but I wasn't doing it to get thanks. You know, it was a mission. We were on a call. We had a calling. We were going to do it whether people supported us or not, you know?
You know,
one final thing. These days, people expect to be thanked for what they do, you know, but for true service for us, there was no thanks to be expected. I mean, it was a matter of doing what had to be done.
It had become a part of who you are and your personal charge.
Right. It defined
us. And I think that is so very much missing. I think people want rewards. They do it to garner rewards. But
and they want recognition.
One of the things that occurs to me as you talk about all of the marches, all of the struggle and protests over the issue of civil rights and human rights and the character of our democracy, is that I do want to make a point here. And the point being that no matter how we feel about this president's policies and the things that he has been cornered into doing or not doing, at the moment of his inauguration, I think I know that I stood there and I had been at the March on Washington, I had been at the Million Man March, I had been at the Million Woman March, I had been in marches almost my entire life that I can remember, and sitting in NAACP meetings and worrying about segregation versus integration, that at that moment I think that our hopes and our aspirations were affirmed. And that is one of the reasons where black people, no matter how or who wants to criticize the black support of President Barack Obama, that it comes from the core of that.
Right.
That
right.
It is an affirmation of ourselves.
Right.
And I think that we have to be mindful of that, and we have to be careful that we don't dismiss it. And Joyce, I don't know how you're feeling about it, but I'm getting so weary at my age about this, not necessarily constructive criticism of the president as the president, but the dismissing of what this has meant to so many people who have struggled for so long.
I agree. I am at 70 years old, I am of the generation that believes that, you know, this is the culmination of a long, you know, half a century of recent American historical struggle, and then we go back, you know, hundreds of years, you know, from the time first put here, and to finally, you know, get a black president is the culmination of that, and we could can criticize him on specific policies, but God knows no one ever in human history has ever had a harder time as he's had being accepted as the legitimate leader of a nation, especially the one that says it's a democracy. I mean,
absolutely.
After waking up every morning, hearing people say the most horrible things about you, people that normally you would be expected to sit down and have some cordial discourse, even if you disagree fundamentally with each other. But people who, I mean, leaders, elected leaders, calling, referring to you as a monkey, and I mean, it's unbelievable. And here's a man who has had to bear all of that and keep a stiff upper lip and not address it at all. I can imagine.
And not acknowledging the limitations of every president.
Exactly.
George Bush didn't have his own agenda. His agenda was given to him because he was the president of the United States, and that's how it worked.
Let me
ask you about your scholarship and your work as a sociologist. And for those of you who are listening, Dr. Ladner is the author of The Death of White Sociology, Essays on Race and Culture. And she is the author of Launching Our Black Children for Success, A Guide for Parents to Kids from 3 to 18. She's written numerous books on education, urban issues, public policy, one of them being Tomorrow's Tomorrow, The Black Woman, The Ties That Bind, Timeless Values for African-American Families, Mixed Families, Adopting Across Racial Barriers, and The New Urban Leaders. Tell us about how you have done, how you entered into and have formed and framed your scholarship as a sociologist.
Well, I, even though I'm a scholar, I have always had this very personal need to be as authentically myself as possible. I mean, I've gotten roundly criticized for putting myself on the pages of some of my scholarly research and writing. But that's who I am. I think I would be a mediocre scholar if I didn't do it the way I do it. But again, it comes, all of my work has been guided pretty much by this basic premise of trying to use my training in sociology and public policy to find solutions to, if not solutions, certainly greater understanding of the causes and consequences of the issues that face us. I started out very early on. I finished my doctorate when I was in my mid-20s, actually 24 years old to be exact, and I had spent about 4 years doing research on adolescent girls, black girls in St. Louis, Missouri. I was at Washington University of St. Louis. And I remember early on, as I interviewed these kids, I did a lot of observations, spent hours and hours with them, with their families, hanging out with them, as kids say today, and really trying to get to know them. I was doing ethnographic research. I was interested, as it evolved, I realized what I was really interested in was the impact of race and class on their development, on gender development. This was long before we began, even before I thought of it as gender. I was looking at on development of women, on young women. We didn't have the theory on feminism and womanism and all that back then. So, and this is 1964 when I began the study. But I wanted to, early on I began to think of it in these terms. What if my parents had been part of that migration north from Mississippi? And what if they had stopped and settled here in St. Louis or in Chicago or Milwaukee, Detroit, one of these Midwestern cities? Would I be one of these girls here today? They were all poor girls. I was third oldest of nine children. Would my parents have fared better? And I began to see myself subliminally in the beginning, I think, quite subliminally, but I began to identify with them because I could see, but for the grace of God, there goeth I. I could have been one of them. I mean, these kids who had, a lot of them had gotten pregnant, struggling to try and get back in school without the resources. They had been dumped into, the public housing project, Pruitt Igoe, that ultimately became the dumping ground for the poorest of the poor. And I think it was my empathy, my ability to be empathetic, that guided me to much deeper understanding of who they were, and I think it also engendered their trust. And that's how I started out. I was 20 years old when I went to grad school, so I wasn't much older than, I had a few girls who were 18, so I was almost their age.
Uh-huh.
And so over time, they trusted me enough to tell me their stories, but I never had the feeling that they trusted me entirely because they couldn't. I was very different. I had my own apartment. I was at this fancy university that they'd only heard of, and some of them had never heard of it even. And I'll give you an example of how they trusted me, but they didn't at the same time, of how they showed me that I really wasn't one of them entirely. They always talked about going to this dance hall on Wednesday night, and I kept asking if I could go with them. I wanted to see, part of an ethnographer's work is to see your subject in as many natural surroundings as possible. Finally, they said I could go. And I had an old 1960 Rambler car. I drove it down there and I parked it, and then they saw me. So you can't go dressed like this. I was dressed like a graduate student. So you got to change these clothes. You'd be embarrassing us. So they had me put some. They dressed me up. I don't remember exactly what I was wearing, but I didn't look the same, for sure.
The BOGO boots.
Something like that. So we went outside their apartment. They were living in this 11-story, high-rise buildings. They were 11-story high. And they said, well, where's your car? And I had left my car parked far away because I wanted to experience it. I wanted to know how they got there on Wednesday nights, who took them, etc. And they got upset because I didn't have my car. And so we went to this main street, Franklin Avenue, in St. Louis, and a few blocks away from there where they lived. And they hailed down. I was wondering, well, how are we going to get there? So they started hitchhiking. My mother told me, don't get in the car with any strangers. So I got piled in the car with this very nice man who was on his way home from work, and he dropped us off it was like a Masonic temple where they had these dances. And when we got there, I didn't realize that they didn't have any money. They started panhandling for the 25-cent fare to get in. And I had to do what they were doing. I couldn't pull my money out of my shoe. I had hidden it, or in my bra, one or the other. I can't remember which. So what happened is that when they got their got their money quickly. They said, well, how much do you have? I said, I don't have any. They said, you can't do anything right. So I felt so totally inadequate. And I started asking friends to give me some money. I got a few pennies from somebody, and a kid boy gave me a nickel. Finally, I got my 25 cents. And we went inside, and I didn't realize they set me up. First they gave me an identity. They told me that you have to tell people that you're from Arkansas and you just got here, and you live with your grandmother and you don't have a telephone, and you can't or your grandmother won't let you talk on the phone, so you can't give them your phone number. And I said, okay. Then they had we're all sitting around along the wall, and then they had a little boy who was like half as tall as I was. I was 5'6". And he came over to ask me to dance, and I didn't really want to. I was very, very embarrassed by the whole thing. And they pushed me out on the floor, and he had his little arms around my waist. His head was about just around my bust line. And he was trying to pull up close to me and grind, and they cracked up. They were laughing. They had told him to do this to me. I realized that night, you are not one of these kids. You can do your research all you want to, but they have the power over their own lives. I wrote it up. But it was, I mean, they were, I challenged, you know, the prevailing theories and notion back then that these kids came from disorganized, dysfunctional families. I mean, they were very functional. They didn't have money. Parents were living in poverty. And they were struggling to do the best, very best they could, you know. Mm-hmm. But they certainly had a strong sense of self, strong sense of positive identity. I mean, they knew who they were. They weren't all downtrodden. I mean, they could set me as a doctoral student up for sure.
I thought about you and the guidance and the direction that you have taken, how we approach using sociology as a way of examining programs and solutions. And I thought about you today when I read a report that mm-hmm. the teen pregnancy rate in the black community over the last 5 years has decreased by 51%.
Right. I don't know if it's that high, but I know it has steadily gone down.
Well, I want this audience to know that the work that you did has advanced at the time how we think about women and families in our community, and it really informed the work of people going forward so that they're not distorting who we are.
Right. You know, one of the things that I was being taught, I mean, I had professors who was one of the leading experts on the disorganization and the pathology of the black family. And here I was, a lowly graduate student who was bringing all this data back to my professor when I would go out to interview people, and I'd bring it back, and he was writing it up. And I didn't believe in that, but, you know, how do you challenge a professor and tell him he's wrong, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I was so determined that if I got the chance when I finished and got my degree, I would write I would analyze this data and write what I wanted to write, and that's exactly what I did.
Uh-huh. Is that how you came with the death of white sociology?
No, it was Tomorrow's Tomorrow, the Black Woman, that was based on my dissertation. That was my first book.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote in the beginning of that book, in the introduction, I remember starting out by saying, I don't know whether this book had its beginnings with me when I began studying graduate school, or if it had its beginnings when I was just in my study and came and got a copy of it, or whether it was, just a second, here's the sentence, it is very difficult to determine whether this book had its beginnings when I was growing up in rural Mississippi and experiencing all the tensions, conflicts, joys, sorrows, warmth, compassion, and the cruelty that was associated with becoming a black woman, or whether it originated with my graduate school career when I became engaged in research for a doctoral dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to say that I am sure that the 20 years I spent being socialized by my family in the broader black community prior to entering grad school shaped my perception of life, defined my emotive responses to the world, and enhanced my ability to survive in a society that has not made survival for blacks easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was how I framed the book. And instead of taking that data and and just saying that these girls are in mostly female-headed households, and their mothers are poor, and they're uneducated, and they're migrants from the South, da-da-da-da. I turned it on its head and said, and in fact, it's a pathological society that keeps people oppressed like this.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, and that
and
it's not...
you were a pioneer in taking those broad steps forward with that ideology.
But I didn't have any idea that that was what I was doing at the time. I mean, because you have to, I always say that we were very young back when we were in the movement, we were doing things. And you have to keep thinking of people in their natural, no matter how, we were ordinary young people who were taking extraordinary efforts to
mm-hmm.
bring about change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think I was
an
ordinary grad student who just happened to have had the opportunity to have grown up in a society that taught me that we were highly functional people, that we were strong, tough-minded people. I mean, my mother and her family, you know, for generations had passed down to us that you're as good as anyone. You're as good as anybody. And when you talk to white people, look at them dead in the eye and don't blink. And stand up for what you believe. Now, my mother didn't know that I was going to stand up and go to jail, but never said anything about it because that's what she had said, stand up for what you believe in. She always also said, you know, your beliefs aren't very important if you can't defend them, you know?
You know, my mother had a discussion with me about what I was doing here in Boston when I was a college student. I was my dad had to come and arrange for a bail for me, and I was a summer school student at Palmer Institute, and we ran away trying to join up with SNCC, and we were too young, and they caught us in D.C. and sent us back to school. We had actually gone AWOL. But my mother said to me in one of those events where I was involved, I had gotten arrested at Boston University, and she was having a discussion with me over the phone, and she said, "You're not a student at Boston University. Why were you even in the building?" And I said, "Well, you know, there's so few black students in Boston, we all have to band together, so we just go from one school to the next." And then I got arrested at Brandeis. And my mother said to me, she said, "You know, you're going to have to decide whether you're going to do hard time or you're going to do good time." And I said, "Well, I guess in the world where I live, and the things, the thoughts that move me, I'm going to have to do hard time."
Mm-hmm.
And she
mm-hmm.
said, "Well, you've got to be willing to pay the consequences, but
right.
we can't be bailing you out of jail every time you decide you're going to do your hard time."
Yeah.
So I do think that the lives of activists evolve around what you think has to be done. It is compelling.
Right. And you've just got to do it. My sister is a perfect example of that. Now, Dory dropped out of college three times. And I remember one time she said, "Joyce, I can't study while my people are suffering." And I was just trying to figure, well, I'm not getting, you know, doing the best work I can by far because I'm trying to do both.
Mm-hmm.
But I could stay in school. She said she couldn't because her people were suffering and she had to be out there. And that was, it comes as close to a calling, and it's only been in recent years
yes.
that I understood that was a calling.
And you have to make hard choices when you stand your ground on principles that you believe in, just as you've said.
Right.
You know,
as I write this book now about the coming of age during that era, I keep trying to think not as how I, at 3 score and 10, understand life now, but how did I understand it at age 17, 18, 19, 20? You know, and how, even in graduate school, when I finished at 24, how did I think then? As opposed to, you know, I'm not one who will say that, well, I understood what I was doing. I didn't really, I mean, I may have had some elementary understanding of it, but I didn't have insight. I didn't have the wisdom, the understanding that comes through wisdom, that comes through years and years of rolling these things over in your head and thinking about them in context. Mm-hmm. We were very responsible young people. We were, people say, you were so brave. I don't think we thought of ourselves as brave. We just thought of ourselves. And we were careful, too. We didn't jump out there and try, I mean, and incite people to hurt us at all. You did everything you could to try to be as safe as you could within a very dangerous situation.
Yeah,
but,
that's right. And you worked in a dangerous era. People have to understand how dangerous it was to do the work that you did as a young person.
Yeah, and we were chased by, on those dark, lonely roads, you know, this is back when they had two-lane highways.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I always said, that people in SNCC had different skills. And the best skill, one of the most important skills that they could have was being a good driver. I remember Stokely Carmichael, Cleve Sellers, Ivan O'Donnellson. Those guys could drive some cars.
On the dirt roads, on the back roads.
Yeah, in and out of, you know, in and out of dangerous
situations. I tell people, wasn't no 95.
No. In and out of dangerous situations, I mean, the ability to get you out of danger. And they used to tell us to sit in the back seat. Girls, you know, sit in the back seat. Now, when I hear, this brings up a real sore issue for me. When I hear people talking, white feminists now saying, if they didn't like to type and they were told they had to stay in the office and type, they wanted to go out to organize. I did not want anybody in my, those women out in the neighborhoods organizing when the cops are going to see them out there and come down on all them and all of us.
Mm-hmm.
It had to do, I mean, you had different skills, but but when a guy asked me to sit in the back seat because we were going in through a dangerous part of a town or whatever, I was so glad to get back there. I didn't know what to do because they were risking their lives for us.
Up front. Yeah, that's right.
My roommate was one point, and then I'm done. But my roommate was a white girl from Virginia, Joan Trumpower Mulholland. She was a freedom rider, a wonderful, brave girl. Now, Joan, I used to carry a black silk scarf in my purse or in my pocket so that on those times Joan was in the car with us, especially at night when we were on our way back to campus. Dark, long miles and miles of stretches of road without street lights. I used to make her put that scarf on, and most of the time she had to ride on the floor. And there was no question about it. She couldn't argue about it. I'm going to sit up. I said, no, you're not. You're not going to get me killed. And that was the context. You know, all of us wanted to survive. And we didn't want her killed, but we certainly didn't want to be killed either.
Mm-hmm. And as you were rolling through the dark dirt roads of the Deep South, organizing our people, empowering them to find their liberty and to enjoy democracy, did you ever think that you would become the president of Howard University for a year?
No way. I didn't even think of me. Again, we didn't think about those things.
Uh-huh.
As young
uh-huh.
people, you thought about maybe next year, but not. I mean, first I was going to be a social worker. When I was a little kid, I wanted to go to college to learn how to help people. That's what I called it. And eventually one of my mentors gave me a name for it. It's called social work. And then in college, my last year of college, I decided I was more interested in understanding the causes instead of, so I wanted to study sociology and went first, you know, I went to grad school direct from college. I left immediately. And I always said I was in school from age 3 1/2 to 24, and that was it. I was done. I don't want to study anything anymore.
You know, it's really interesting. I have to tell you this really quirky kind of story. On the morning that it was announced that you would become the interim president of Howard University, my granddaughter was born.
Really?
And my mother called to find out how the baby was doing, and I picked up the phone, and I said, her name is Imani, and did you hear about the woman, Dr. Ladner down in D.C. has been named president of Howard?
Oh, my God. Your mother was not even there. She was thinking about her first grandbaby. That's amazing.
Yes. Joyce, we only have a short time left, and we've got someone who would like to talk with you. So we'll go to our phones, but I'm telling you, you've been on my radar a long time.
Well, thank you.
I even went back to West Palm Beach, and I wanted some of the, you know, the overalls that you had on.
Oh, yeah. Jones,
I wanted overalls. I wanted those overalls. 979, you're on the air with Dr. Joyce, a Ladner witness from the bridge.
Yes, Dr. Ladner, this is Tommy Curry.
Oh, hi, Tommy, how are you?
My son, good.
Yes, ma'am, long-time fan. You know, read practically everything you wrote.
That's nice to hear.
I want to ask you, you were talking about your passion with social work, what brought you into sociology. You know, I'm doing some work writing on, you know, on your work and, you know, tomorrow. What inspired you to talk about young black girls specifically and in from the frame that you did from black family studies? What generated that? What formed kind of your intellectual and political heritage?
You know, it may be disappointing to know this, but it wasn't political, intellectual at all. It was very personal. My advisor, Lee Rainwater, who directed the Pruitt-Igoe Housing Project study that I was a research assistant on, which I was paid to go to graduate school, he told us that we could study anything we wanted to. And I was just thinking, he said, well, what are you interested in? I said, well, maybe women, you know, because I'm a woman. And that's exactly what I said. There was nothing high-minded about it at all. But, you know, underneath it all, there must have been some subliminal interest or desire on my part to understand women and therefore myself better.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'd say now as an informed person. But at 20 years old, you ask me, what do you want to study? And the thing was wide open. I could study anything. One of my friends, Ethel Sawyer, was studying gay women, you know, lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
Boone Hammond, who died, was studying. Was my counterpart. He'd already begun. He was two, three years ahead of me, but he did the male counterpart to work I did on girls. And my roommate, Gwen McGee, who became a textile artist, worked with Jules Henry, the anthropologist, and studied the schools. So I just said, women, girls. And that was it. But it was all a matter of evolution. It evolved over time.
The title of the book is Tomorrow's Tomorrow, The Black Woman, A Study of Poor Black Adolescent Girls from St. Louis, and it was published first in 1971. How much, Dr. Curry, can she be a pioneer?
How much can she be, say again?
How much more could she be a pioneer?
Oh, it's unquestionable. Unquestionable.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But you know, go on, I'm sorry.
No, it was just
George,
saying.
You
I mean,
have
you know,
to understand how much your work, here's Dr. Curry, who's continuing to examine the work that you did in 1971.
Well, when Tommy Curry first contacted me on Facebook and told me his interest, I was so pleasantly surprised. I'm always surprised when people find are interested in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's because I don't take it for granted. I mean, and especially, the book became a classic, but after 40-odd years, you know, it's nice to know that it still resonates and that people find something in it to look further at. But I don't want to overemphasize the fact that when you're young, you don't have a lot of self-awareness. Mm. That evolves over time. And I started out certainly not with the wisdom I have now by any means, but you have to be courageous enough to keep searching and searching and searching and curious. If I tell students, if there's one quality I like in you among, more than any other, it is curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to keep exploring and to keep trying to, you keep raising questions with yourself that you want to answer, so you keep digging and digging and digging. Had I not had curiosity, I would have been just another tenured professor toiling in obscurity somewhere in some place. No, seriously, but, you know?
And I hope that you are looking at the issue of how important that work is, because it is informed by the time. It is
absolutely
informed by a culture that has diminished in our society, and a culture where black adolescent girls were essentially, at the time, invisible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think the other thing that I encourage students to do, and that is to be curious, but also to be courageous. And courage is not the absence of fear, but the ability to act in spite of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
to prevail in spite of it, but to keep plodding along, you know. And it's not necessarily giant steps. It's oftentimes slow steps, you know, one after another. But you got to stand up for what you believe, and sometimes those beliefs may not be the most informed, but if they hit you in your gut right,
yes,
that's
ma'am.
What I call authenticity. Your work's got to be authentic. I mean, you got to mm-hmm. feel, it's got to resonate with you as the truth. And I know there are various definitions of truth, but, you know, you just got to feel like this is right, you know, and I got to keep mm-hmm. digging. I'm going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Dr. Kerr, we look forward to your work and examining
you,
and incorporating and the work of Dr. Ladner, because it is important to keep that discourse, that dialogue, that investigation in front of us.
Well, I want to, you know, commend Professor Kerr, Tommy.
Yes, ma'am.
To
Tommy J.
Tommy J, right. What does the J stand for?
Jermaine.
Oh, Tommy Jermaine. Okay. I want to commend you on being interested in women and feminism, or womanism, you know, black women's studies. As a man, number one, and you're going up against the tide so much because...
yeah, you see that on Facebook too, huh?
Yeah, that the women who are in the established black feminist studies don't like the work you're doing, but you got to keep doing it, you know?
Yes, ma'am.
That's
I
right.
appreciate that.
You've
yeah.
got to bring clarity to
yeah,
the
you got to break out of the pack, too.
That's
well, you know,
right.
our foremothers, you know, that's one of the reasons I like reading your work, LaFrance's work, you know, even Staples and Harris, you know, both of them's work, is that I think that it establishes a very clear principle about what our people were about, men and women, you know.
Right.
And that's one of the things, you know, even when I read The Death of White Sociology that you edited, it's very clear that y'all are working from different paradigms that don't seek to reproduce the eras of Eurocentric thinking. And
right. I'll tell you how that title came into existence. I was, I had put together this collection of essays, and I didn't have a title. And Charles Harris, who was an editor at Random House, asked me, he's a black guy, and Charles asked me, well, what is your title going to be? I said, I don't know, I'm thinking about an introduction to an introduction of black sociology. And he said, no, you got to have something catchy, like, what about something like The Death of White Sociology? And I said, well, okay, if you say so.
that was my question earlier. That's a that's a great summary of how it came to be, because people like me, we have thrived. I mean, I was in the corporate world, but there was an undergird to help me understand myself and where I was in all that craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me to fight back the mass media conception of who I was.
Right, and I'm sure you had a tough time in the media trying to remain clear-headed and present the truth as you knew it, you know?
Absolutely. Dr. Curry, thank you so very much for
your
comments.
Thank you for having me.
And so glad to have you with us on Saturday night.
Yes,
You keep stringing those beautiful, beautiful pieces that you're stringing. And
yeah,
Prince is going to keep coming for you. Thank you so very much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Tommy J. Curry and Our Common Ground voice. He has been with us a number of times. Dr. Joyce Ladner, truly looking at the world from the bridge that you have both built and maintained has been such an absolute pleasure.
I've enjoyed it very much.
And I am so privileged. We are at Our Common Ground, so privileged to have had us with, have had you with us, and we hope that we can have you come back to talk about just your work on black adolescent girls, because it's something that's on our agenda as part of our theme this year of Black America State of Emergency.
Okay,
and we haven't seen very much about how we reconstitute our communities around black girls.
Well, I think it's an important study topic that we need to engage in serious dialogue about, and we need to find support systems for young girls. I know a lot of people are working in that area, but there can never be too many.
Absolutely. So thank you so very much for being with us. You are truly an authentic witness from the bridge.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Good night.
Good night. I have so much enjoyed that discussion with Dr. Joyce Ladner, and we certainly hope that she'll be coming back at Our Common Ground now that she is an Our Common Ground voice and a witness from the bridge. You're listening to Our Common Ground. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap this up. We invite you to join Peter E. Matthews on Soul Emergence, Tuesday nights, 9 p.m., Soul Emergence at TruthWorks Network.
Where reconciliation is the tool of revolution.
Soul Emergence with Peter E. Matthews, only on TruthWorks Network, the Black Voice Collaborative.
TruthWorks Network. Truth works. TruthWorks Network.
Live from the TruthWorks Network studio at Blog Talk Radio and Our Common Ground Media Production. The Black Voice Collaborative.
The Alpha Show Alpha, serving his politics with hot grips. Soul Emergence with Peter E. Matthews. Reconciling for Revolution.
Special broadcast series, Twerking While Black, Black Women in the Prison, and Power Views. The truth must be spoken more than once. Only on TruthWorks Network. You can find TruthWorks Network on Facebook. Like us and learn more about us.
Us here tonight at Our Common Ground with our witness from the bridge, Dr. Joyce A. Ladner. What a magnificent, outstanding example of black womanhood she is. We thank Dr. Tommy Curry for his call, and we thank you for being with us in our chat room. Loads of people have joined us tonight to gather together to listen to the wisdom, the history. I mean, when you think about history, we always think it in the context of people who were. Joyce Ladner is a person who is. She's working on her memoir, Stand Up Straight, Coming of Age During the Civil Rights Movement. Don't forget, if you have not, you should very much put into your library the books of Joyce A. Ladner. Let me give you that list once again so you won't be lacking in terms of what you should have read. The Death of White Sociology, Essays on Race and Culture. It was published by Black Classic Press. Launching Our Black Children for Success, a guide for parents of kids from 3 to 18. Tomorrow's Tomorrow, the Black Woman. And we're hoping that we will have her back to talk about Tomorrow's Tomorrow. The Times That Bind, Timeless Values for African-American Families, Mixed Families Adopting Across Racial Boundaries, and The New Urban Leader. Those are all books we recommend for your library. Thank you so very much for being with us. We'll be right back here on next Saturday night at 10 p.m., Transforming Truth to Power, One Broadcast at a Time. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you.
Thank you for joining us here at Our Common Ground tonight with our witness from the bridge, Dr. Joyce A. Ladner, to remind us that we all must participate and be part of lifting up our people, and that we have a living presence of history that we can learn from. She came to change a nation and lift up a people. Thank you, Dr. Joyce A. Ladner. Join us each Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, here at Our Common Ground, Transforming Truth to Power, One Broadcast at a Time. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you.
And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, 'cause we're headed far.
why was he shot down the other day? Are we headed for the brain? What's gonna happen now that the king of love